And joining us to review some of the issues of the second working group is Thomas Homer Dixon. He's the director of the Trudeau Center for Peace and Conflict Studies and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto, and has long studied questions of the environment and conflict. Welcome once again to Living on Earth, Professor Homer Dixon.
Very good to be back.
So, which of the two or three areas in the world or nations are going to be hardest hit by the impact of climate change in these earliest years of climate change?
In general, the places that will be hardest hit are the poorest places on the planet, and places where governments are ineffective or corrupt, where people are already vulnerable in a lot of ways because of poverty, because of ill health, because of malnutrition. So we can quickly identify a very large part of Africa is probably at risk. A lot of equatorial countries will see their agricultural regions pushed into temperature ranges that may damage their crops quite significantly. Places where water is already very scarce will be vulnerable. The Sahel area in Africa below the Sahara Desert is one region that's very susceptible to relatively small shifts in precipitation.
It sounds like the American Southwest as well.
In general, this latest working group report from the IPCC emphasizes the differential impact of climate change that's going to affect poor zones in the world and poor people in poor countries. But when we look at rich countries, you can identify some vulnerable regions too. And the Southwest in the United States, especially along the Colorado River Basin, is very clearly one vulnerable region. The division of water that's available in the Colorado between the various states that have a right to the Colorado water was decided at a time when there was a fairly substantial flow in the Colorado compared to present flow. I think the decision was made in the 1920s. And now we're going to find that a steady decline, in part because of climate change, in the flow probably of the Colorado River, and that's going to produce a lot of tensions over water allocation in the Colorado Basin.
So let's spin the globe here. Where might we see these types of conflicts arising?
You would look at those places in the world that are already, in a sense, on the edge, where there is simmering conflict below the surface. Countries such as Pakistan, I think, will be significantly affected by climate change. Now, that's a country that's already stressed from multiple directions, economically, demographically, in terms of a war next door in Afghanistan. And there's a great deal of environmental damage already across the, especially the rural areas of the country. If you put climate change on top of that, it could precipitate agricultural shortfalls, economic crisis even, and lead to even greater turmoil in Pakistan. There are a number of countries within Africa that are potentially vulnerable. In southern Africa, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, South Africa. In China, I think we have some significant vulnerabilities. China is suffering from very significant water scarcity already by it because it's overdrawing its aquifers. If you add climate change on top of that, it's going to make the water situation worse. Now, there are, I think, genuine concerns in China that climate change could make it very difficult for China to feed itself. Now, that will have economic implications for the whole world.
And I would imagine internal conflict as well.
The issue for China, of course, is that it has to maintain the growth rate of between 7 to 10% a year just to keep the lid on simmering tensions within the society, especially between the haves and the have-nots, the people who have benefited from rapid economic development and very large numbers of people, perhaps 800 million or more people who've been essentially left behind. If the agricultural economy is threatened, then it could produce tensions, disputes, and even violence across the country.
Revolution, perhaps, in China?
China is a complicated case, as is always true. There are multiple stresses the country is facing in terms of its internal finances, its banking system, its energy supply. It's become a net energy importer very dramatically over the last decade and a half. And it all depends, from China's perspective, on whether it can maintain very rapid economic growth. Of course, the larger problem is that this economic growth is also producing huge emissions of carbon dioxide. We should not assume that China is simply going to be the next great superpower on the planet. It has an enormous number of internal vulnerabilities, and a new one is climate change.
In the reporting of this part of the climate change assessment from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I've detected a sort of an intellectual concern by many in the affluent part of the world that, oh, you know, this is going to happen to the poor part of the world, but not a sense of threat to the more affluent part of the world. Those folks who live in North America and Europe and such, where there are a lot more resources, how safe is it for us to be complacent about these early days of climate change, or how vulnerable might we be to the conflict that could be touched off by this?
One of the things that concerns me about this report in particular is the way that it might be interpreted by people to suggest that, well, at least for a while, the New York Times suggested perhaps one or two generations, rich countries don't have to worry very much because they're smart enough, inventive enough, and wealthy enough to respond to climate change dislocations. They can develop new crops to grow in hotter, drier climates. They can desalinize water. In Holland, they can make their houses so they float up and down depending on whether the sea level is going up or not. I think that this is entirely unwarranted complacency. I think we'll find out in a relatively short period of time, certainly within the next decade, that rich countries are enormously vulnerable to climate change too. A major drought in the United States in the interior grain-producing regions is by no means an impossibility, and it's simply not a case of being able to invent our way out of that problem. So we really are, globally, as a species, in the same boat here. It's true that wealthy societies and wealthy people may be able to buffer themselves for maybe a couple more decades, but ultimately we're all going to share the same fate. In the short term, when climate change affects most immediately poor zones of the world, if we have breakdown of societies, governmental disintegration in those zones, that's actually bad for everybody on the planet. You get large migrations out of those regions, and taking disputes and conflicts far abroad, overloading social services. Also, to the extent that areas of the world become much more violent and perhaps anarchic, you get healthcare systems breaking down. Diseases start to become endemic in those regions that can then spread out around the planet in our highly interconnected world. These also can become zones for terrorist activity, bases where terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda can set themselves up and then branch out around the planet. So for a whole variety of reasons, we should be very concerned about what happens in poor parts of the world and the stresses that poor countries are facing right now, including climate change.
So looking at prosperity and the impact of climate change, what are the prospects that the wealthier advanced societies will be more prosperous in the years ahead despite climate change, as well as what are the economic prospects for the poorer nations?
The general assumption is that the world economy will keep on growing, and keep on growing despite climate change at a fairly rapid rate. I'm a little bit skeptical. I think that the combination of this energy transition from a petroleum to a post-petroleum age and climate change will actually crimp economic growth, we're going to find that these factors will be constraints, that it's going to become increasingly difficult to maintain the very rapid growth that we've seen in recent decades. That raises real issues because we use economic growth as one way of alleviating tensions between rich and poor people within our societies and among our societies. If we can't rely upon economic growth to do that in the future, we're going to have to work out other ways for resolving those age-old conflicts between rich and poor.
And what might those be?
Well, let's put it this way. At some point in the future, we're going to have to start moving towards a steady-state global economy, which basically will mean that there will be a fixed and perhaps declining throughput of energy and materials through our industrial processes, so that our load on our natural environment as a species is capped and then starts to decline. It's not fair to ask the poorest regions of the world to cap their economic growth and their rapidly increasing material and energy throughput in their economies. If we aren't prepared to strike the global bargain that allows those other people to start to approach our standard of life, then there will be very serious conflict ultimately between rich and poor people around the planet. And we're not remotely prepared for dealing with these right at the moment.
So that's a pretty dark scenario. What are the choices that the planet could make to have, let's say, a rosier outcome?
I think that fundamentally the issue that we're confronting here is one of democracy. It's a question of whether we can collectively decide to solve our problems after participating in a conversation, not just within our societies, but around the world as to how we're going to do it. Right at the moment, our democratic institutions, even in the most democratic societies in the world, are, when it comes to this kind of problem like climate change, significantly dysfunctional. But there are other places where we see new things happening. Local level activities, just an explosion of activities around the world where people are undertaking attempts to solve local problems. We're also seeing new attempts at democratic discussion. But I think what we're seeing in many respects here is a failure of our political systems and our technocratic elites, our management elites, to actually come to terms with a very critical problem. And in many respects, the problem is not a technical one. And we're thinking of it in terms of technology and in terms of technical fixes of various kinds. In many respects, the problem is one about values, about what kind of life we want for our children and for our grandchildren.
Thomas Homer Dixon is director of the Trudeau Center for Peace and Conflict Studies and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.